Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof on News Talk. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Coming up on this week's programme, does the universe have a purpose? As always, we start off the programme looking back at some of the more interesting stories from the world of science. And joining me is Dr. Laura Dungan and Dr. Ruth Freeman from Science Foundation Ireland. Our first story has to do, Laura, with bees.
It does, yeah. And obviously there's no such thing as a positive climate change story, but I feel like more and more stories about climate change are talking about, can we adapt? What are the ways to adapt? What are the animals and plants that can adapt? And this is on that vein. But my favourite part about this whole story is it came from a lab mishap. There is a type of queen bee called a common eastern bumblebee. And when she has not yet mated, she hibernates underground. So she digs herself a little burrow and she hibernates underground through the winter. And there was a researcher in the University of Guelph in Canada who was studying these bees who accidentally had a little mishap and poured a load of water in on top of these hibernating bees and didn't realize, and then came back to find them still alive, which was quite interesting for this researcher. So they thought, look, let's, you know, make hay while the sun shines. And they basically drowned nearly 130 bees. So they split them into two groups and they let half of them float back up to the surface and they kept the other half down with plungers. And they kept them down for 8 hours, 24 hours or 7 days. And believe it or not, 7 days underwater did not kill these bees. And I can't quite wrap my head around it. I suppose it's because their metabolism goes into such a level of shutdown while they're hibernating that they're able to survive without oxygen for 7 days. But the controls, 88% of them were alive after the 7 days. And of the submerged bees, 81% of them were still alive after 7 days. So it's absolutely fascinating. So what they're suggesting is that these bees might be more capable of surviving flooding as a result of climate change. Now, there's no evidence that their larvae would survive the flooding, so it may not be of massive benefit, but it's really interesting that these bees can live underwater for a week.
Is it surprising? Aren't there lots of animals that can survive underwater?
We call them fish, Johnny. It's incredibly surprising. These are obligate aerobes. These insects, they breathe oxygen. Well, I suppose they don't breathe oxygen, but they utilize oxygen for their cellular respiration. So this is genuinely shocking. Like, I couldn't believe it when I read this story. I think it's absolutely amazing. There are, of course, animals that can dive for, you know, a few hours at a time, whales and seals and all these things. But I mean, hours is one thing. 7 days is shocking, I think.
Yeah, no, because I mean, there are like the tree frog, for example, turns into practically, a block of ice. But I guess that's an amphibian and it has a totally different physiology. But I'm interested that you are so surprised about this. I mean, surely insects would require a lot less oxygen. Is there possibly oxygen in the water that they're using, or is it just they do not breathe for this week?
But you can't extract oxygen from the water unless it's something that you do regularly. I mean, that is what gills are for. Oxygen is not something that you can just take from water unless you have been designed and evolved over millions of years to do it. So one can only assume that they do not require extra oxygen, whether or not there's enough oxygen in their body already, whether there's a tiny bit stuck in their fluffy little bodies. I honestly don't know, and neither do the researchers, but it is, I think, absolutely phenomenal. Insects can survive for short periods underwater. Of course, we know that. But for a week, I just think this is absolutely mind-blowing.
I feel like I don't know enough to be surprised by this. I think that's what I've just realized, and I'm starting to sound like an idiot. So I'm going to move on to our second story, which is an interesting one. It's not really a science story, Ruth, but it caught my eye because here we have a very high-profile figure essentially saying that a space war has begun.
That's right. So this is comments from Bill Nelson. And Bill Nelson is the chief administrator of NASA. And he was testifying in front of the House Appropriations Committee about NASA's budget for 2025. And essentially what he said was that China is using civilian space programs as a cover for military objectives. And he's very worried about this. And he had a sort of call to action to the US government to say, we need to invest more in our space program because we need to get to the moon. Otherwise, we're going to lose our global edge in terms of space exploration. And he's very worried about that, because what he's saying is he believes, obviously, that there's things going on with China where they would like to get to the moon. And although we do have some very old treaties, there's a treaty from 1967, which is the Outer Space Treaty. So most of the world's nations have agreed that no one can claim territory in space, and that the moon is only to be used for peaceful purposes, and that you're not allowed to have weapons in space. But of course, what he's saying is whoever gets there first and manages to establish some kind of presence on the moon, you know, it's kind of like, well, I got here first, who's going to come and stop me from doing what I want to do? And of course, we know, if you think about the South Pole of the moon, that's where a lot of countries have their eyes on it. They'd like to get there and land, because that's where we've seen evidence of water. So of course, whoever gets there first, if you set up your base there first, you know, do you potentially have a head start in terms of extracting resources, in terms of being on the part of the moon that is most likely to be useful?
Useful for what, though? I mean, let the Chinese go to the moon. Am I being really naive here?
I mean, I think there's probably a number of things to kind of think about here. And there are actually sort of citizens groups that are kind of looking at what should happen with the moon. So you might remember, actually, a couple of years ago, somebody wanted to send human remains into space. These were cremated remains, and the idea was that they would put them on the moon. I think it was actually one of the Star Trek actors whose remains he wanted to have them on the moon. But there was certain Native American tribes, and they found this really challenging, because for them, the moon is a sacred place. They thought it would be desecrated by having human remains there. So there's lots of different relationships with the moon if you look across different cultures.
Yeah.
And I suppose, I mean, what people are discussing is, you know, who's to say you can't go up and put a big advertising sign on the moon? Who's to say, you know, you can't leave rubbish on the moon? All of these things. And again, there are resources there. So, I mean, we're obviously living in an age of mass extraction of resources from our own planet. You know, there's only finite resources on the moon as well. You know, are we just going to go and extract all the resources there? What do we think about the impact of that for future generations? So I think, you know, this is kind of a call for discussion as much as anything else.
It obviously has echoes of the Cold War and the space race back in the 60s. But it seems to me to be, I don't know, it seems, either it seems like there's a lot we are just completely not clued in about in the general public, or that the sort of paranoia that we see in military worlds is causing this trouble. I mean, there is, of course, the high likelihood that this is just a strategy for getting more funding from the government, by making them feel a little bit like, oh, we need to up our funding.
Yeah, it's not going to escape anyone's notice that he was in there pitching for NASA's budget, you know, and it has gradually been creeping up. But look, I think exactly like the Cold War originally, there is a sense of this having an impact. Whoever leads in space, there's a sense of being a global superpower. Mm. And clearly America doesn't want to step away from being seen as a global superpower. So there's certainly a psychology to all of this as well. But still, like, that treaty is very old, and it does seem like it probably needs to be thought about again in the light of, you know, the 21st century.
Yeah, I mean, it's also naive to think that America is not also putting things in space in this regard, because, I mean, after all, Trump has created a space force, which every time I say those words out loud, Our third story has to do with work and health, Lara.
It does, absolutely. And in Ireland and across the world, we are living longer. If you look at 1940, the average age that we would die in Ireland was 59. Now our lifespan is 82 on average in Ireland. And there's more of a focus now on health span than just lifespan. And this is research that was done in the Oslo University Hospital of over 7,000 Norwegian people in 305 different occupations. And what they did was they split them into four groups based on routine task intensity in their job. So essentially, what has the most random and changeable tasks, or what has the most routine in the job? And they found that the people who were in the lowest routine task intensity groups had a 66% increased risk of mild cognitive impairment and a 31% increased risk of dementia. And they said these were jobs like road workers or postal workers, or especially the people who deliver the post, and people who do cleaning. And if they looked at the top groups, they counted people who were teachers or university lecturers in the ones that had the highest level of changeability in their job. Now, obviously, we know that education counts for an awful lot in terms of our long-term resistance from dementia, because we build up this sort of cognitive protection by higher levels of education.
Is that
right?
They
did account for that. They do, yeah. And this has been long recognized, that the higher you are educated. Now, some of this is that people who are higher educated tend to come from wealthier backgrounds, which means they can tend to afford to be healthier people overall. So there is a lot of bias in this. And there's a lot of unfairness, but they did account for the education level, and they say it only contributes to approximately 60% of this study. So they took people who had the same education level, but who worked in very different routine intensity jobs. So they do still say that this is not all based on education. So what they're saying is not, it's hopeless. If you happen to love your job as a postal worker, that's fine. But they're suggesting that maybe you should take up more hobbies, for instance, learn an instrument, learn a new language, and that might help with your cognitive reserve and help stave off things like cognitive impairment and dementia down the line.
Did they control for income levels, quality of life, food quality, and so on? Because you'd imagine that people who have very repetitive jobs are also probably on the lower end of the spectrum when it comes to pay, and therefore probably on the lower end of the spectrum generally in terms of opportunities.
Absolutely. I mean, it's undeniable. There was a huge amount of control. They controlled for age, sex, education, income, hypertension, which is high blood pressure, obesity, diabetes, psychiatric impairment, hearing impairment, loneliness, wow, and smoking status. So they did account for a huge amount of things that can adjust it. So it was a very well-controlled study. But you're right, there's an awful lot that can control whether or not you're going to go towards dementia. So it's very important to have control in these studies.
Brilliant. Our final story, Ruth, is not, I suppose, unrelated, but it's to do with something that I often enjoy, although this week, having seen Liverpool absolutely limp out of the Europa Cup, I'm not sure I'm enjoying it so much anymore, watching sport.
It is. It's about the enjoyment we get from watching sport, although interestingly, they don't seem to control for whether your team wins or loses in this study. But it is from Japan, from the university, Waseda University, and it was published in Sports Management Review, which I will confess, it's not a journal that I have a subscription to. So I wasn't able to read the original study. And it does, I have to say, this study has been called groundbreaking and revolutionary, but I've seen those words replicated across all the news media outlets where it was published, which makes me think they all came from the original press release. And I would probably take some of that with a pinch of salt. But what they did was they did three different things. They used a sort of multimodal analysis to see what kind of impact does watching sport have on us, and particularly on our sense of happiness and well-being. So the first thing they did was they looked at a big publicly available database where they could look at 20,000 Japanese residents and looked at the influence of watching sport. And what they found was there was an overall pattern of better well-being associated with regular sports viewing. And obviously that's self-reported data, which of course has some limitations. So then they went on and they did, again, it was an online survey, but it was more detailed. They had just over 200 participants here, and they got them to watch various sports videos and then answer questionnaires, which would try to assess their well-being before and after the viewing. And what they found again was that people, after watching the sports videos, had an enhanced sense of well-being. And as they put it, widely embraced sports in Japan, like baseball, had a bigger impact on people's well-being than in Japan. Apparently a less popular sport is golf. So that didn't have the same impact on Japanese residents anyway. But then the third part of the study, which is where we're probably getting into more of the meat, is they used an MRI. So they got 14 people into an MRI and they analyzed their brain while they watched sports clips. And what they could see was that the reward center of the brain was activated by watching these sports clips. I mean, back to what Lara said, they didn't talk about what happened in the brain when they showed them other clips. So I don't know if they had good controls in there. But what they also said was, of those 14 participants, the ones that regularly watched sport anyway had greater brain volume essentially in their brain's reward centers. So what they're actually claiming is that doing something that you enjoy all the time is actually, I suppose, fortifying those circuits in your brain so that you actually feel better overall all the time.
Well, we'll see if my well-being improves when Liverpool play Fulham later on this afternoon. But for now, Dr. Ruth Freeman from Science Foundation Ireland and Dr. Lara Dungan, thanks for joining me.
Now, for the most part, science deals with the how rather than the why of things. It can tell you about the mechanism, which we call the Big Bang, that brought the universe into existence, but it can't give you the why. We leave that for philosophers to ponder, but my next guest straddles the two disciplines to a degree, and he believes that there is scientific evidence which points towards the universe having a purpose. So this should be interesting. Philip Goff is a professor of philosophy at Durham University and the author of Why, the Purpose of the Universe. He joins me now. Welcome to the program, Philip. Why did you want to address this? It's a fairly big idea that you want to straddle here.
Absolutely. That's a good question. Well, you know, if you told me 5 years ago I'd be writing a book on the purpose of the universe, I wouldn't have believed you. But I think, you know, as you say, we tend to think these days that that's a sort of ridiculous idea that science has moved on from. But I just think, in a way, this cultural bias may be stopping us sort of dispassionately thinking about the evidence. And the more I've looked at this, the more it seems to me there is reason to take seriously some kind of goal-directedness at the fundamental level of reality, that the evidence is there and possibly we're overlooking it just because it feels a bit weird. Maybe it's a little bit like in the 16th century when we started getting evidence that the Earth wasn't in the center of the universe. And people struggle to accept that because it didn't fit with the picture of reality they got used to. I'm starting to think that something might be true about the current scientific situation right now.
My problem with this idea of there being a purpose to the universe is it implies some sort of agency, like that there is something. You can't have a purpose without a subject of that purpose.
A lot of people have that intuition. But, you know, the very idea of a law of nature was initially essentially connected to God. The idea was this is the divine command maker who gives his moral laws and his laws of nature. But I think over time we've managed to separate the idea of a law of nature from the commands of God. I think maybe likewise we can begin to dissociate the idea of a purposeful law or a natural tendency towards a certain goal from the idea of some conscious mind that's behind it.
Okay, so I feel like we're dancing around semantics here. Let's talk about the proof. So as we say, you're not suggesting that maybe the universe has a divine being that sits on a cloud or whatever. But you're also not happy with the brutal unlikelihood of just randomness in the universe, and that's how we have come about. Why do you not think that we are just a fluke of physics?
Absolutely. I think so many people in the West feel they have to fit into one of these categories, don't they? Either you believe in the God of traditional religion, or you're a secular atheist. You know, it's like, whose side are you on, Richard Dawkins or the Pope? And I've slowly come to think that both of these worldviews have things they can't explain about reality. The God hypothesis has the deep difficulty of reconciling the existence of the terrible suffering we find with the existence of an all-powerful, loving God. In terms of the familiar secular atheist position that we live in,
and the fact that there's no evidence whatsoever anywhere of any deities at all.
Well, that might be another issue. But in terms of the traditional secular atheist idea that we live in a meaningless, purposeless universe, I think there are a few things this is hard to fit with. Perhaps most striking is the fine-tuning of physics for life. This is the discovery of recent decades that for life to be possible, certain numbers in physics had to fit in a quite precise range. They had to be like Goldilocks porridge, not too big, not too small, just right. And on the face of it, it seems incredibly improbable that those numbers would have fitted in that very narrow Goldilocks range just by chance.
But I always think of this as when I read a book that's kind of like James Bond-esque, and I go, there's no way he would have been able to walk over those five alligators and make it over to the other side of the water. But this is the story of the James Bond who did that. And the story of the James Bond who got eaten by the alligator is not a story worth telling because he doesn't win in the end. And isn't that the same idea with the improbability of our existence? Yes, it is highly unlikely that we happened, but we are the ones that did, because there was nearly infinite amount of time for matter to come together, energy to come together, and that's what happened.
Yeah, so I mean, of course, all kinds of improbable things happen, and no, I think we're happy to accept that flukes occur when it's not too improbable. You know, you're thinking of someone and they phone you or whatever. But when we get to a certain point where something is unbelievably improbable, I think that's no longer the rational option. I mean, just let me give you a simple example. Suppose bank robbers break into a bank and there's a 20-digit combination and they get it right, you know, first time in 5 seconds. And we're considering two hypotheses. First hypothesis, they had inside information and someone told them. Second hypothesis, they just guessed and they got it right. I think everyone would agree that the rational thing hypothesis to go for is the former hypothesis, because the latter is just too improbable. Now, the second point you made there, well, there's been plenty of time in the universe. The universe is a big place. However, what we're talking about here is the basic principles of nature that have governed all of time and space from split second after the Big Bang. So unless we think there's something outside of our universe, and of course that is one possibility we might want to discuss, it really isn't an option to say, oh, you know, it's not just a matter of space and time. These are the numbers which govern all of our universe.
But when you talk about large numbers and you say, well, it's over one in a million or it's one of a billion, I mean, we're using tiny earth minds to conceive of these numbers, right? It's not like it's not like those numbers are big to everybody. They're big to us. But if you consider, you know, stars in the universe, these numbers seem actually quite pedestrian. And so when we're talking about these extremely improbable numbers, there's a huge amount of space for those improbable numbers. And those improbable numbers are only improbable to us because we live in Newton's universe.
Of course, you know, we have to be very careful when we're dealing with probabilities. But, you know, I mean, all of science is based on our capacity to evaluate the evidence, evaluate the probabilities, and try to work out which hypothesis makes the evidence most likely. And, you know, we're lucky that we have a mathematically precise way of understanding what evidence is and how it works, something called Bayes' theorem, very important when tracking the COVID pandemic. And this is what I go into in a great deal of detail in the book. I hope this is one of the most accessible explanations of how Bayesian probabilistic reasoning works. So of course, you know, I mean, we have to be careful, make sure we're thinking about this correctly. But we also have to be careful that we're not letting our current cultural biases that, oh, you know, this feels a bit weird, this feels a bit odd, block us from dispassionately evaluating the evidence.
Right. Okay. But you talk about evidence, right? And mm-hmm. Is there more than just the unlikeliness for this idea that Earth has some sort of a purpose, or our universe has some sort of a purpose, that there is some sort of agency, or there is a reason behind everything? Because if it's just unlikeliness, I don't consider that to be a book of evidence worth considering.
Maybe I could give you a concrete example. The example that's most perplexed cosmologists revolves around dark energy. This is the force that powers the accelerating expansion of the universe. We discovered in 1998 that our universe is not only expanding, but accelerating in its expansion. And so scientists postulate a repulsive force called dark energy. Now, once you do the calculations, it becomes apparent that if that force was a tiny bit stronger, everything would have pushed apart so quickly that no two particles would have ever met. We wouldn't have had stars or planets and so on. Whereas if that force had been a little bit weaker, it wouldn't have counteracted gravity, and everything would have collapsed back on itself within the first split second of the Big Bang. So that number had to be not too big, not too strong, not too small, just exactly right. And so fundamentally, we face a choice. Either it's just an unbelievable fluke,
the
number is as it is because it's the correct number for life because there is some kind of directedness towards life at the fundamental level of reality in the very early universe. And as I said, this is something our best scientists and philosophers have been able to make rigorous sense of as a possibility. The only question is the evidence there? Now, you say to me, okay, well, you know, is that all there is in probability? But this is how evidence works, right? Whether it's physics, whether it's history, whether it's a detective trying to solve a crime, we understand now, thanks to Bayes' theorem, how evidence works. And how it works is we look for the hypothesis which makes the evidence most likely. Many cosmologists, for example, believe in inflation, which is the hypothesis that there was our universe began with a very rapid period of expansion. Now, we can't directly observe that. Why do scientists believe in it? Because it makes the evidence more probable. It removes some of the improbabilities. When we've got an explanation that can remove improbabilities, that is the rational thing to go for. Now, if you tell me, well, this explanation feels weird to me, so I'm going to stick with improbabilities when I don't need to, I would say that's the very definition of a bias.
Well, yeah, but if you're gonna say, well, the numbers are so far out there, let's imagine a giant butterfly is out there flapping its wings and conducting the universe towards a certain path. I mean, the thing is, what you're saying is that the numbers out there just imply that there must be some purpose, and that, I just don't buy that as an idea. And I'll also draw.
You haven't given me any reason at all why you don't buy that.
Well, because I know humans have not yet gotten to a stage where they fully understand dark energy. I have a and there are a growing number of scientists who feel that the numbers may not necessarily be right, or they might be thinking differently about dark energy. And the numbers that we have, all of these improbables, highly improbable numbers, they're all based on our own mathematics in 2024. I do think we will have a greater understanding of how the improbability of this universe will come to pass in time. But I think creating something that we have no evidence for, we just think, oh, well, it's not even like dark energy where we can observe that there is something there inferred by a gap. It's well, this is just so crazy. There must be some puppeteer behind it. It just makes no sense to me as an idea. Do you have an idea of what this thing is that creates purpose?
So this is, I mean, maybe a common response to say, oh, well, you know, science isn't complete yet. Maybe this has changed. Maybe the evidence will go away. I mean, maybe it will. Maybe in our future theories, this fine tuning of physics will disappear. Maybe it'll get more. All we can ever work with is the evidence as we currently have it. Mm. And again, I would suggest it's a definition of a bias to say, oh, well, I'm not going to draw any inferences from our current evidence. I'm going to wait for...
I'll give you that.
Is complete. I mean, it's ramping up the standards of evidence in a way we would never do in any other case. I mean, let me give you the other example again of cosmological inflation, this belief about the very early universe. Why do we believe that? We believe it because otherwise the evidence is incredibly improbable. It's the hypothesis that makes the evidence most probable.
But it is based on observation, that. Right? It is that is based on observation and of the physical universe, right? It's so not based on, well, the numbers here seem kind of crazy, okay, so let's create some.
No, it's exactly the same. And anyone who has a basic understanding of Bayesian probabilistic reasoning.
Well, I don't have that.
But let me just say why it's exactly the same. Scientists believe in cosmological inflation because it's the evidence it's the hypothesis that makes our observations most likely. I'm making exactly the same.
No, you're not. You're not, because you're not talking about observations. You're talking about probability.
I am.
Observations are different from probability. We observe our physical universe. We see matter. We look at the stars. We see stars moving away from each other, and we infer inflation from that because we physically see it. We don't physically see unlikeliness of numbers.
We don't physically see inflation. We do not physically see inflation.
But we do see stars and universes moving away from each other, right?
Yes. And we do. Our current best scientific theory is that the laws of physics are fine-tuned for life, in the sense that for life to be possible, these numbers had to be just right. That is observed empirical evidence. What I'm talking about with teleological laws, which is something we can make precise sense of, is the hypothesis that makes those observable data most likely. The fine-tuning of physics for life is observable data. The hypothesis I'm talking about is the hypothesis that makes that data most likely. It's exactly the same kind of Bayesian argument as with cosmological inflation.
All right, just to finish up, if this was, say we put this on the table and we say, look, let's examine this more closely. How do we go about gaining better scientific insight as to what might be going on here? If we say, all right, the maths don't add up, this is improbable, too improbable to be fluke, there's someone or something guiding the universe in this way. How do we go about exploring that from a scientific point of view?
I mean, we don't want to be too mystical about it, like someone or something. What I'm talking about is a paradigm of explanation, a way of conceiving of laws of nature, thinking of, so our current paradigm, maybe I can be a bit more precise about this. Our current paradigm, right? Laws of nature go from past to present. What happens in the present is determined by what happened a moment earlier. In the paradigm of these goal-directed laws of nature, it instead goes from future to past. So what happens in the present is determined at least in part by the necessity of getting closer to some future goal. And that's something we can make mathematical precise sense of.
Really interesting to speaking with you. I don't think either of us were dispassionate, we have to say. Philip Goff is the author of Why, the Purpose of the Universe. Philip, thanks for your time. Love to know what you made of that and whether or not you're convinced by it. Or if indeed, and we rarely open the door to this, but if indeed you believe there is a purpose to the universe, whatever that might be, God's plan or mathematical, you know, bizarreness, let us know. You can send us an email, science@newstalk.com, or you can find us on Twitter. We're at @newstalkscience. The podcast is a bit longer this week because we've got loads of your stories about near-death experiences, and we want to read them because they're great. Aidan McKelvey, producer, joins me in the studio to talk about it. Have you ever had a near-death experience?
Thankfully, no. No, I don't.
I think I'd like one.
I don't know if anyone I know has either.
I think I'd do a real Fight Club thing, you know. You remember that moment when Tyler Durden points the gun at this kid and says, you're gonna live, and you better live this day, the best day of your life. You better go do that course and, you know, go to university or whatever. I think I'd have one of those moments where I just, like, everything would become clear.
That's what you do after it.
After it, I think I'd probably be like, I'd find purpose.
Yeah, you'd be, I'm
scrambling around for purpose. I'm looking, you know, behind the sofa cushions. I am, you know, in the attic trying to find purpose.
Sure, you just got a healthy dose of universal purpose there a few minutes ago.
Yeah. Right. So we're speaking to Jimmo Borgigan about near-death experiences and the evidence there is a biological mechanism that underpins these sort of things that we hear about. Michal has emailed and he says, I had a near-death experience in the 90s. It was an accident with a conveyor belt. I had so many injuries, traumatic asphyxia, heart attack, blood on lungs, kidneys, liver, and innumerable breaks. And the consultant said he had three similar cases. The other were not as severe and the other two were dead. Jesus. I found the horrendous pain was inspirational and it informs my happiness to the present time. I changed. I learned to enjoy life, work less, and perhaps to be less giving of my time. Otherwise, I'd probably have greater empathy and generosity than before. I think that would be me. I think I would find empathy. This thing of which you speak.
Yes.
Cold affected me much more and my physical prowess took a long time to recover. Okay. I had a period afterwards where I told a lot of lies. My marriage ended and I acquired a voracious sexual appetite. That is not unusual. Some trauma happens in the brain and people become super, super horny.
Really?
Yeah. This coupled with less fidelity to partners, I'm glad to say I'm now with a wonderful woman who is my soulmate. The lies and cheating have ended. I have to admit I don't regret the hedonism and indeed have not kept them from my partner. That's just a flavour. The time and pain and illness was almost a religious experience. Wow. That's a book, Michal, dude. That is a book. Get yourself an agent. This is a long one. This is from Tom Evans. Hi, Jonathan. I've had one of those experiences about 6 years ago. Great show, by the way. No problem. Thank you. I am an engineer in a previous life, 25 years. So enjoy your work at every level. I was reasonably fit, 52, father of kids, stressed to the gunnels as my marriage was on the rocks. We were on holidays in Mallorca, just day two, when my heart stopped as I cooked breakfast. No alcohol, no drugs, no hangover. It just happened. I reached hospital on time, thankfully, and had an emergency external pacemaker fitted. It was the next morning when I had more invasive surgery to have the permanent pacemaker fitted when I had the experience. It was a local anaesthetic, and I remember when I felt any pain that I'd focus intensely on my kids to help me through it. I was doing this for them, as I still do today. So out of nowhere, I saw myself on this picturesque, old, ornate infant stairway to the clouds. Really? I'm on step 3 and heading north. Plenty of nice foliage, plants, flowers on each side. I remember consciously saying, no, I've got to stay. I've too much to do here. They need me, my kids. I turned around and climbed back down. The experience changed my life slowly over the next few years. My marriage ended over the following year. I work as a psychotherapist and my heart is now my ultimate instrument in trauma work, profoundly attuned and I to it consciously. Incidentally, the physiological reason for my cardiac stoppage has never been ascertained conclusively, but attributed to a sinus node dysfunction on dorsal vagal nerve. I have my own theory as well as the stress levels mentioned. I was cooking breakfast on an induction hob, which I'd not seen before. Being a former techie, I was very curious and I was pressing everything on the touchscreen, not really sure what I was doing, as the menus were in Spanish. As I've since discovered, there's a recommended 10-centimeter no-go zone over induction hob surface. And it's because the electromagnetic field falls away logarithmically over that distance, being negligible at 10 cm. Now, I'd just come in from the pool, I was still wet, and as I rested my chest on the front of the hob within the 10-centimeter zone, I started to feel dizzy and collapse to the floor. I estimate I was lucky at approximately 6 to 8 different junctions of the entire experience. And my heart stopped 3 times. I was in the ambulance for the 3rd event and needed convulsive intervention. So some light reading there for you, Jonathan. Thank you for the opportunity to relay it to you. Tom, listen, I'm glad you're still with us. Really fascinating story and glad to hear that you are at one with yourself. I'm not sure about the induction field and whether or not it's really really that negative to our health, even if we are very close. I have an induction hob. It's not something I've ever heard of, but thanks for your email anyway. Maybe if there's an engineer out there who can back up what Tom's saying. What do you make of that?
Yeah, well, I found it's very interesting that the two first near-death experiences we've had, both of their marriages split up. And our first guest, like said, our first writer said that he kind of became, as you said, very sexually active and kind of promiscuous and dishonest. It's interesting because it's obviously there are social norms and it seems like
I was nearly dead, dude.
Yeah.
I am like going.
Social norms out the window.
Yeah. You kind of feel like, you know, I always said, like, if I was on death's door and they were told, right, you're going to go, you know, that's it. I'd be like, give me some heroin. And I'd be like, I've got nothing to lose then, right? So your social norms go out of that. Probably would not happen.
Yeah.
But like that's, you know, I would feel like I've got nothing to lose. And I think if you're given a second chance, if you're that close to death and then you're not, then certainly you go, what am I going to this flipping meeting for? What would I do that for? I don't want to do that. I'm not going to the meetings. You know, I think, you know, more precious with my time, as Michal put it. Yeah. I think I'd be very precious. I'm pretty precious as it is.
The interesting thing is you, after the near-death experience, you haven't actually really learned anything you didn't already know. Mm. It's just being reinforced to you.
True.
Yeah, which I find interesting.
Yeah, but it's, context is everything, right?
It is, yeah.
Charlie says, hi, Jonathan. You asked for people's experiences. My experience is not completely in that area, but here goes. Immediately after a very bad anaesthetist injected me for a really mundane, simple procedure, my heart stopped for what they said was 4 seconds. So they decided to inject me with something else to restart it. Bad for me, but also bad for your research, because I did not experience anything at all. I felt nothing until I woke up with a massive pain in my chest and head after the botched also to make it a perfect mess procedure. But I experienced nothing at all during it. In my case, the drugs they were injecting, I'd now say abusing my body with, may have had made such awareness more difficult. But sorry, I don't appear to be of any use. However, perhaps it will be, as it shows, that not everyone experiences anything. The reason, that's up to the experts of the research, right? I found this morning's show brilliant. Sometimes the odd expert can be poor communicators. Not this morning. All right.
Sure.
You know, you could have just said it was great. Each commentator was clear and the information was really significant, interesting and important. Please don't dumb down if any pressure comes on you guys to do something like that, as we are not as dumb as broadcasters like to think we are. Thanks, Charlie. Well, I would absolutely agree. I think most people are much smarter than we give them credit for. But you do have to explain things. I think, you can be really smart and bad at communicating. Nina says, I've had a few experiences. Most real and profound was New Year's Eve 2012, hero dose of synthetic DMT. Full travel through the tunnel of light and eventual rest in the garden at the end, surrounded by familiar energies with the fundamental understanding that I had come home. Wow, this is a really, that's a proper experience, isn't it? I have a detailed written account of this, which I put to paper the day after, as I feared the memory of it would dissipate in the way dreams do, but it didn't. I remember it clearly to this day as a real lived experience. Wow, tunnel of light and resting in a garden, knowing it was all over. I'm a professional freediver and have blacked out, suffered hypoxic loss of consciousness on a couple of occasions. Not something I'm proud of, but it happens. I've had the tunnel of light experience and time expanding while out, but not as significant as with the DMT. Photo above is of me unconscious being retrieved by a safety diver at the 2022 Freediving World Championships. Also a book. Nina, yeah, also a
definitely
book.
A book. Right front cover of the book there as well. The,
I would like life. To. I would love to have you on one of our events and talk about that experience because that is amazing, Nina. Thank you. Another says, I heard your program on near death experiences. I don't know what I had during the unconscious periods of my cardiac arrests. The third of which I was hooked up to a remote heart monitor. So there's a record of that one. My heart stopped for over a minute. The first one felt much more severe to me, so I imagined my heart stopped for a significantly longer period during that time. During my first cardiac arrest, when I was unconscious, in my mind, I was in an impending car crash. I was doing 70 miles an hour heading for a solid wall. I knew it was going to be a severe crash with broken bones. I was, in my mind, possibly actually physically pressing hard too, standing on the brake pedal as hard as I could, trying to get the car to slow down, but no effect. It was very frightening, this feeling of going to be severely injured in the next few seconds. The car wouldn't respond to the brake pedal. No slowing down at all. It was going to be a big impact. Gradually, I remember regaining consciousness, a man asking me what day it was, where I was, etc. And I became lucid quite quickly and then vomited all over myself, which is always nice. During the second cardiac arrest, during the unconscious phase, I felt that I had fallen off the side of a cliff, was free falling through space and was flailing wildly to get a grip on something, anything. I don't know if I was physically moving my arms during the time, but I do remember being absolutely petrified. It was by far the most terrified feeling I've ever felt. Horrific, flying through space, accelerating towards a very sudden impact, heading towards the ground. If you're not good on roller coasters or in fairgrounds, when you're dropped suddenly from a height at 0G, that was a feeling, except I was going to die at the end of it. Again, I regained consciousness and was fully lucid quite quickly. So a brief description of my two cardiac arrests, for what it's worth. Well, Kevin, holy crap, that's a lot to have gone through. And I'm so glad, as I say, that you are well and with us. They are not nice near-death experiences, are they? You kind of want the other ones. You want the tunnel of light in the garden and chilling out.
Definitely. It sounds like there's a psychological aspect to what you, hallucinate is the wrong word, what you experience.
Yeah.
Like maybe if you're anxious already, you're obviously going to be anxious. Maybe you've got anxiety in your life running up to it, you have an experience like this, or maybe not.
Yeah, that there, crap. Like, if you're going to nearly die, you at least want to have the nice white light sort of vibe. We were also talking about anger. And there was this story that Philip told us that research shows that if you're angry about something, write down what you're angry about and then rip it up or throw it in the fire and really shred it up and you will find that the anger dissipates a bit. We have an amazing email in from a person we'll call Jenny. She doesn't want to use the name and you'll find out why. She says, Dear Jonathan, I go to bed and can't sleep sometimes because I'm so angry with my husband. I tried your test. I wrote it down, shredded it, balled it up and threw it away. Lo and behold, I got instant relief from my anger and I went to bed relaxed and happy. Is this a joke? Like, can it be that simple? That's amazing, Jenny. I'm delighted. Sometimes I find my husband so annoying that I am saying, fuck you, under my breath several times per day. This is definitely not harming him, but it is me. I will continue to experiment. Kind regards from a normally nice person. So on the face of it, if you have not lived through marriage, you might go, well, that's destined for disaster. This is a terrible relationship, right? But sometimes you can just get angry generally. Sometimes I find like it takes my wife or I, maybe just having not eaten and a few things to go wrong, and we're straight into the F-bombs, right? Sometimes. Now, it's never, and this is important, it's never spiteful or mean, but it's often just a, fuck you, you fucking fuck, that sort of thing, right?
Yeah.
And that's actually, I don't think, always indication of an awful relationship. Sometimes we can just wind each other up, but most of the time, we're not like that. If it's every single day, Jenny, I think about that. What do you think about that? You have a loving relationship.
I mean, you're very chill. It doesn't mean we don't have arguments. I think you're right. Like, especially if over time it's just two human beings in the same room, they're gonna have conflict. But as you said, if it's very regular, maybe that's not a great thing. That should be not the norm. That should be like, oh, you should walk away from that going, oh, I shouldn't have said fuck you there.
On Otzi, so we talked about Otzi the Iceman as well, and Brian Richardson says, hi guys, I was driving home from work and listening to the episode about the mummy Otzi, and I popped into Dunn's to pick up a bottle of wine. I was drawn to a bottle of 061 red wine, as I'm from Limerick. 061 County Coat, that's amazing. I started reading the label and nearly keeled over when I saw, insert Twilight Zone music, the label has Otzi the mummy on it. It's actually O with an umlaut, and it's named after him. It's a Cabernet Sauvignon. You can get it in Dunn's and you can see it there. Otzi the Iceman. See, unlikely things do happen, as I would say to our guest of this podcast when he tries to tell me that unlikely things don't happen. That's pretty unlikely. That's it from us. Thanks to Aidan McKelvey, the rest of the team. We'll be back with more Future Proof on Tuesday in your podcast feed. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland.
Sunday morning at 10 on News Talk.